This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The problem is with us female voters. We have more women voters than male voters, but we do not support each other. We just need to learn to support each other and ensure we occupy the decision-making positions.
That was Tenda Moyo, an independent candidate in Zimbabwe's coming elections, on women supporting each other. Details coming up on our coverage of today, International Women's Day. Also, two prominent African women were among the 11 honored by the U.S. State Department, and Malawi's children are at risk of cholera. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. As Zimbabwe prepares for national elections later this year, women advocacy groups say they do not expect to see more female candidates winning races. Rutendo Mawera in Harare has more on this report on International Women's Day.
Zimbabwe will head to the polls by August and political jostling has already begun. Linda Masarira is the president of the opposition Labour Economist and African Democrats Party. She says it is unlikely that there will be any increase of female representation in politics because men dominate decision-making posts in most of the political parties.
Most of the mainstream political parties are led by men. Hardly have any women in the presidium. Then when we come to the women-led parties, we're trying to emancipate women participation in politics and empower women to participate in politics. We are labeled all sorts of names, denigrated, put in certain corners, painted black, so that we do not succeed in the emancipation of women participation in politics.
Stembiso Nyoni is the Women Affairs, Community, Small and Medium Enterprises Development Minister. She says women can help each other succeed.
We need to help each other as women to come up with the programs that will give confidence to women to stand as political leaders. But for me, it's not only the political sphere. It's in every sphere of life. The women must be there. We can't have the world being run by half of our gender.
While a lot of gender activists suggest patriarchy and lack of resources as key barriers for women, Tendai Moyo, who is running as an independent in a local authority race, says women have much of the responsibility for the problem.
The problem is with us female voters. We have more women voters than male voters, but we do not support each other. We just need to learn to support each other and ensure we occupy the decision-making positions.
After the 2018 election, a Zimbabwe Electoral Commission survey showed that women made up just 15% of the candidates for House of Assembly seats and 17% of the candidates for the local authority elections. The electoral body noted in the report that, despite constitutional provisions aiming to promote gender equality, the number of women who contest and eventually win in elections remains low. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
As mentioned earlier, today is International Women's Day. United Nations Women and the UN is celebrating under the theme Digital Innovation and Technology for Gender Equality. In several African countries, far fewer girls attend school than boys due to a number of factors, including cultural norms and a lack of education funding. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell recently accompanied First Lady Jill Biden on a five-day trip to Namibia and Kenya. In the second and final part of their conversation, she spoke with VOA's Carol Van Damme about Biden's efforts to encourage more families to send their girls to school.
Did you ever get a chance to speak with Dr. Biden you know, one-on-one? And if so, what did she say about her experiences on the trip or whatever you wanted to talk to her about?
So, Carol, I did get to talk to Dr. Biden at 1 a.m. on the tarmac in Naples. And I have to tell you, that was an off-the-record conversation. But what I can tell you is that she said that this was a life-changing trip for her. This is her sixth visit to Africa. So I really like to know a bit more about what she meant by that. But she clearly took on a lot of the information that she heard. And she was constantly seeking more information from everywhere there, much like a teacher, much like an educator, much like an academic.
And a mother.
Yes, and a mother. And she did really flex her mom power on this trip. She brought along her granddaughter. And when I say mom power, I mean that in every sense of the word. Because if you look in your own life, who's more powerful than your mom?
Exactly. That's a great place to end it. Thanks, Anita.
Thank you.
That's VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell. She was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam. Two African women were among the winners of the 2023 International Women of Courage Award bestowed by the U.S. State Department. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and First Lady Jill Biden recognized 11 women from around the world who have demonstrated courage and leadership in advocating for peace, human rights, and the empowerment of women and girls. Among them were Professor Danielle Darlan of the Central African Republic and Maza Mohamed of Ethiopia. Darlan, who is the former president of the CARS Constitutional Court, was recognized for her defense of her country's constitution, her defense of judicial independence, and her refusal to bend to political pressure during coups and years of civil conflict. Maza Mohamed is an Ethiopian journalist and founder of Roha TV, an independent YouTube-based news and information channel. Her reporting has included speaking with survivors of gender-based violence, including survivors of the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Since March 2007, the Department of State has recognized more than 180 women from more than 80 countries with the International Women of Courage Award. You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Economists say sustained electricity outages have plunged Africa's second largest and most industrialized economy into deep recession. They say investors are leaving South Africa, businesses are closing, and thousands of jobs are being lost as the economy contracts. The depressed climate, rising crime, and high food and fuel prices are sparking growing anger with anti-government protests set to begin within weeks. Darren Taylor reports.
The government released figures Tuesday that showed the economy shrank by 1.3% in the final quarter of 2022. The news ignited an immediate slump of South Africa's currency, and it fell to almost 19 rand to the dollar. Its value last dropped so quickly and so low during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. The newest government financial report shows losses amounting to billions of dollars in almost every sector of the economy, with gross domestic product shrinking fast. Some economists, such as Azar Jamin, blame bad governance and a surge in rolling blackouts because the national power company, Eskom, no longer can generate enough electricity.
The real danger is that this contraction in economic activity stands to continue in the short term. One is particularly scared of the winter season when the demand for electricity is set to rise by a further 4,000 megawatts. We're already short of around 5,000 megawatts.
The governing African National Congress acknowledges that corruption and mismanagement under its watch badly damaged Eskom. Eskom now implements load shedding, cutting electricity in stages from 1 to 8. The higher the stage, the longer the outage. Government says renewable energy projects are in the pipeline to take pressure off failing coal-fired power stations. But some energy experts say it'll be about 2 years before they make a difference in supply. with daily outages now up to 12 hours and sometimes longer. Jameen says the economy and therefore people's lives could get much worse this year. Many groups, including civil society, opposition parties, and foreign governments, warn the climate is ripe for violent anti-government protests.
This is the big danger about an escalation of load shedding, and we've already seen that to a large extent with stage six. So long as we were in stage two or even stage four, we were somehow managing to just shut down and then restart. But what we are seeing with stage four to six, a lot of activities are unable to restart, a lot of appliances get damaged, and the ability to just reconnect is also impaired. And that's a huge danger. And you're likely to see more and more such knock-on damaging effects if we escalate.
Jameen says the energy crisis shakes the bedrocks of the economy, including mining, manufacturing, and agriculture. These sectors, he says, are losing thousands of jobs, adding to what's already one of the highest unemployment rates in the world. The country's third biggest political party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, is spearheading a national protest action over the economy, the power outages, and other issues on March 20th. Business groups, major labor organizations, and even some embassies have warned protests could turn violent. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
There were reports of continued fighting in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, despite the announcement on March 3rd in Luanda of a new ceasefire accepted by the M23 rebellion. As the ceasefire was scheduled to take effect, clashes continued and both sides accused each other of launching attacks on their positions. For more on the situation in Eastern DRC, Douglas Mpuga reached reporter Jafar Al-Ketanti.
M23 announced to sign a ceasefire, but they don't respect it. So we can say it's held because there is fighting in many different places. And yesterday there was many civilians who was injured because of some rockets landed in an IDP camp in Sake near an orphanage and killed two orphans. So we can say the ceasefire is respected or even held.
This ceasefire is supposed to have taken effect on Tuesday. Who do you think, according to your sources, broke the ceasefire? Was it the M23 fighters?
It's complicated. The two parties accusing each other. Yesterday in the evening, the spokesperson of FRDC, which is the Congolese army, did a statement showing how M23 violated the ceasefire by attacking FRDC position in four different places. And today, I personally talked to the spokesperson of M23, who also accused FRDC and rebel groups to attack their position in west of Sake. So FRDC accused M23, M23 accused FRDC and local militia. But one thing is true is like M23 launched some rockets on the FRDC position, and some of those rockets landed in Sake. So we can't be sure which part started hostilities, but one thing is true, there is no ceasefire. Fighting is still ongoing.
What is the role of the South African forces? Is there a role they are playing in making sure that this ceasefire holds?
Since they came, even locals don't understand what they came for. East African Community Regional Forces are doing anything except maybe in diplomacy. But on field, nothing is done. And they are not even deployed in the fighting zone. Burundian came 2 days ago, and they are based in Mubambiro, which is very close to the front line, but they are still not engaged in the fighting. So we maybe wait till this week and we see what will happen. But for now, even MONUSCO or the East African Regional Force, no one is involved in the making this ceasefire respect.
So right now, at the moment, what's the situation? Are there negotiations to make the ceasefire hold?
All negotiations have been done to call for the ceasefire. And last week in Angola, the President Lourenço called M23 to respect, to sign a ceasefire at the end of the last week. And yesterday on Tuesday, March 7, M23 did it, but they didn't respect. Today, I talked to the spokesperson of M23, as I told you. He also called the government of DRC to sign a ceasefire and to talk with M23. So the rebellion is still camping on his position. They want a direct talks with Kinshasa, not by passing on another country or an intermediary.
That was reporter Jafar Al-Katanti. He spoke with Douglas Mpuga from Goma. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, warns thousands of children in Malawi could die of cholera without immediate life-saving assistance as the disease spreads across the country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Malawi is experiencing the deadliest cholera outbreak in its history. The disease has spread to all 29 districts in the country since the outbreak was declared a year ago. The UN Children's Fund reports the disease has affected more than 50,000 people, killing over 1,500, including nearly 200 children. Speaking from the capital, Lilongwe, the UNICEF representative in Malawi, Rudolf Schwenk, warns an estimated 4.8 million children, or 1 in 2 children in the country, need aid and are at particular risk. He says nearly a quarter of a million children under age 5 are expected to be acutely malnourished by the end of March. Over 60,000 of these children, he says, are expected to be severely malnourished.
Please note that a severely malnourished child is 11 times more likely to die from cholera than a child that is well nourished. And a bout of cholera, getting cholera, may amount to a death sentence for thousands of children in Malawi.
Scientists say last year's lethal outbreak of cholera in Malawi was likely triggered by two tropical storms. The Malawi Meteorological Organization warns worse is yet to come. It notes Tropical Cyclone Freddy, which made landfall in Madagascar on February 21st and in Mozambique 3 days later, is expected to bring heavy rainfall to the south of the country. Schwenk says flooding, combined with chronic underfunding on water and sanitation infrastructure and the disruption of cholera prevention campaigns due to COVID-19, is a recipe for disaster.
Because you can combine this with the ongoing annual lean season, which means that millions of Malawians are currently food insecure, and children are therefore suffering most as a result of this crisis. And as the planet warms, Malawi is likely to be hit by worse climate-induced hazards such as stronger storms and droughts.
UNICEF is appealing for $52.4 million to provide life-saving nutritional support for thousands of malnourished children, as well as other essential supplies and services. They include technical support in water and sanitation, as well as child protection and education. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A military court in Somalia's Puntland state today executed 13 Islamist militants and 6 soldiers for killing civilians. Ahmed Mohamed reports from Mogadishu, Somalia.
The military court in Puntland, a semi-autonomous region in Somalia, said that 13 militants executed Wednesday were members of the Al-Shabaab and Islamic State terror groups. The court said 5 Somali soldiers were also executed for killing civilians in Puntland. The court gave no details on the killings. A 6th soldier, who was also found guilty, was spared the death penalty after his family pledged to pay so-called blood money to the victim's family. Somalia's courts allow for out-of-court settlements in murder cases through financial compensation. The compensation amount, usually in the form of camels, was said to be under negotiation. Somali authorities have executed a number of militants in the past year as they wage an all-out war against Al-Shabaab. Somali troops at times have been accused of using excessive force. Last month, a military court in Mogadishu executed two other Somali army soldiers, also for killing civilians. Ahmed Mohamed for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
The members of the Libya's High State Council voted for a constitutional amendment intended to provide a basis for national elections, but the vote's validity has been disputed. On the other hand, Abdoulaye Batali, the United Nations envoy to Libya, told the UN Security Council he would launch an initiative aimed at enabling the organization and holding presidential and legislative elections in 2023. Wolfgang Poschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The High Council of State is an unelected successor to the 2012 elected General National Congress, Libya's first interim parliament. It was enshrined as an advisory body to the House of Representatives, the parliament, in the 2015 Libya political agreement. It has 135 seats, so the quorum is 68. Several High Council of State members and also its chair, Khalid al-Mishri, confirmed that the quorum was reached, although they don't really agree about the concrete numbers. And probably more important, I did not see any further significant statements denying this. So I would say, yes, the vote is validated. And this is a very important one, as it was about the confirmation of the so-called 13th Amendment to Libya's 2011 Constitutional Declaration, which is actually based on the negotiations between House of Representatives and High Council of State. This amendment is about Libya's system of government. It defines legislative competences of the two chambers of the National Assembly, the House of Representatives and the Senate, and of the executive, headed by a directly elected president. Unfortunately, it does not decide about the criteria for the candidates for presidency, which is still an open key question. Now there should be an HR-HCS committee implemented to work on this within the framework of the election laws. So the work is far from done. Nevertheless, while these certainly important questions are still open, the approval of the 13th Amendment makes clear that there won't be a referendum on the faulty 2017 draft constitution as a precondition for elections, which is, I would say, a step forward.
Abdoulaye Batili, the UN envoy to Libya, on Monday told the UN Security Council he would launch an initiative aimed at enabling the organization and holding presidential and legislative elections in Libya in 2023. Mr. Batili cited that he was setting up a steering committee of major Libyan figures to adopt a time-bound roadmap to elections. How was this initiative received by Libyan rivals?
Not very well. Unfortunately, it seems to be it was not very well coordinated before, although Batili had many talks with the people in Libya. It is based on a broad interpretation of Article 64 of the Libya Political Agreement, and many concrete questions about the composition and the tasks of this high-level steering panel for Libya remain open. And also the key question, how should it get legitimacy for its decisions? So the House of Representatives rejected it right away, claiming that the 13th Amendment is the way forward to elections. The High Council of State did not yet reject the initiative, but noted that the solution to the conflicts is not in the hands of Batili, but in the hands of the Libyans. Its chair, Khalid al-Mishri, said it might be possible to harmonize the Batili initiative with the 13th Amendment. Prime Minister Dabeba asked UN to send election observers, and he tasked the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to intensify the work with UNSMI to prepare elections, so he doesn't want to be the spoiler in this game. The Grand Mufti Sadiq al-Qaryani, the very influential Grand Mufti, rejected Batili's initiative and the 13th Amendment altogether. He called on the people to take the streets and to take over the country. I don't think that this will happen anytime soon. His influence is limited. While other Islamists welcomed the initiatives, political parties praised the initiatives. But altogether, I would say these are not good conditions for implementing the initiative. If Batili fails to push forward with his plan, he is politically probably done.
That was Wolfgang Poschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, talking to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Keila Williams, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.